is going to discuss the Laplace example, which is the world's simplest example used by all computer scientists to show their theories, their approaches very successful, and we'll use it to discuss programming and also how the various features affect performance. So the this foil set, which is actually from last year, has two major sections. The first section discusses programming, and the second section discusses performance. We're actually going to do it out of order, because as soon as this foil set ends, we're going to discuss parallel programming using MPI. So the most the order we're doing it in this year is most efficient to do performance before programming. So the beginning of the we're going to just start at the beginning of this foil set, and so this is just some silly introductory title slide, and the next slide actually says something useful. And so this slide here says we're going to solve Laplace's equation. Yes. Is there a problem? We cannot hear you. Why? Did you used to be able to hear us? Hello? 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 Hello, I can hear you. I can hear you. Hello. Why don't you restart Buena Vista? Yes? Okay. What was wrong? I'm not sure. All right, great. All right, turn off your microphone. All right, write something if you can hear me on the chat room. All right, so we're actually getting to the meat of them. We didn't do anything anyway, so Laplace's equation is a partial differential equation, and we'll discuss actually the numerics of setting it up a little later on. It happens to be written in this form on this foil here, d squared phi dx squared plus d squared phi dy squared equals zero, and we're going to do the world's simplest version of it, which is solving this equation for on a rectangular domain with a particular boundary conditions. This would be the equation you'd get if you did electrostatics. Then phi would be the electrostatic potential. Then the box would be some box on which you'd specify the value of the potential. And we're going to use an extremely simple algorithm, which is either called Jacobi or Gauss-Seidel, after distinguished scientists from hundreds of years ago who first introduced the solution of this type. And to explain what the solution means, which is written enigmatically at the bottom of this foil as phi left plus phi right plus phi up plus phi down over 4, we need to draw a picture, which is on the next foil. So the next foil should show a beautiful 16 by 16 grid. And when you solve such equations, which is to find the value of a function defined over a two-dimensional area, the way you do it is you set up a grid, and you're going to find the value of the points on this grid. So we've taken our box, which is the thing that's on the left-hand side of the foil, and then the fact that we know the boundary conditions mean we know all the large black circles at the edge, and we need to find the values of phi at the small dots, which are the 14 by 14 grid inside the outer circle. I've just got the display from JSU. So the big dots are where phi is known, little dots where phi is unknown. And the algorithm you apply is very simple. This is so-called Jacobi's algorithm. You apply it an iterative approach, which means you just loop forever until you reach some condition, and then you take each point which is unknown, those little dots, you assume it has some value, and you assign that value to all points, you assign a particular chosen value, it doesn't matter what it is, to all points in the domain. Then you replace the value at any one point by the average of its four neighbors. So you take phi at any one place is the value of phi up plus phi down plus phi left plus phi right. And that's called the update stencil. So if we go to the next foil, it explains the parallel version. So if we want to solve this problem in parallel, we discussed in some examples that the way to do parallel computing is to use a domain decomposition or data parallelism, which means that if you have 16 machines and you wish to solve a problem with 256 grid points, you'll put 16 grid points on each machine. So what I've done is I've taken that 16 by 16 grid and chopped it up into a 4 by 4 grid, and then each machine is actually going to be calculating, solving Laplace's equation in the 4 by 4 grid. And each of them is going to be applying this update stencil. It's going to be looking at each of those small dots, finding the value of the four neighbors, and taking the average of the four neighbors, a quarter of up plus down plus left plus right, and replacing that in the middle. So now we're going to skip over this section, which is how you code this algorithm up, and move on to the, let me show you the sequential version just to convert this into reality, and then we won't go to the parallel version. So if you like Fortran, this is the one-dimensional version of this, where instead of having phi up the average over four neighbors, we just do the average of the left and the right. And if you look at this Fortran code, it loops over, this time instead of an array of points, a line of points, and replaces each value by the average of the neighbors, and then it actually tests on the absolute value of the change, or the absolute value of the change. Maximum value of the change is less than some tolerance, it stops, otherwise it just keeps on going. But we'll come back to that after we discuss performance. So to do that, I have to jump ahead to this foil 27. So to discuss, you should all have now a foil which says, what does the Laplace update calculation look like? So we have a total of 196 internal points, and the sequential algorithm just does these four floating point operations. If you look at the basic algorithm, we're replacing phi by the sum of four potentials, the four neighbors, and then multiplying by a quarter. So we see we have three additions and one multiplication, four floating point operations. So the total amount of work is 4 times 196, which is almost 800 floating point operations to do one iteration which covers all 196 internal points. So now let's see what would happen in the parallel computing case. Well, it depends a little on which process you're in, but in the general case, which is shown in the bottom right-hand corner, you will see that general processor, because I divided up this range into this domain into 16 blocks, instead of having 256 points, it has 16 points. And so the amount of work, instead of 196 by 4, is actually 16 by 4. So we see here the obvious reason why parallel computing is effective. We divided the amount of work approximately by 16. So if we want to go into a little bit of detail, we'll find that some of the processors actually do less work than others. Namely, if we take a corner processor, then the corner processor has only 9 internal points. So actually, the amount of work it does is not 16 by 4, it's 9 by 4, 36 floating point operations. So if we go to the next foil, which is interesting. So the next foil I have two machines here. The next foil is appeared on one of them, but not on the other. So what this foil says is that it points out that what you have to do depends depends on the particular point you're looking at. So here I've taken one of these corner processors. If I have a point, I've labeled some points A, B, and C. So let's look at A, B, and C. So let's look first at A, which is the middle of those 9 points. So it's in the middle of the 9 internal points. So when I try to do the update, it's actually, as I said, we have 4 points we have to add together, and those are all 4 unknown points. If I go to the point C, however, it's a little more interesting, because the point C, to be updated, needs a point which is stored in another processor, because the point to the right of C is actually owned by a processor which is a different processor, the processor next to the one we're thinking about. The point B is actually also a little different as well, because the point B, one of the points, is a boundary value point. So they all have slightly different circumstances depending on their exact geometrical configuration. So let's look at the issue of communication. So this is pretty important. So if we look at this whole scenario, we see that we're looking now at the graph. This is a foil called communication loads, And we have a graph in the top right-hand corner, and we see that points, we need to do some communication, and all the points is not points on the edge require communication. And the points to be communicated are those points with crosses. We need to communicate all the points on the edge in neighboring processes. So for the processor, which is a corner processor, we have to communicate 6 points. For the points which for the processors which aren't corner processors, we have to communicate points around the entire edge, which is a total of 16 points. So the way the algorithm works in the when we code it in parallel, what we do is we first do all the communication and then we do the updates, because if we do the communication, then the points are already sitting there in the right locations, ready to be included in the update. So this particular foil also makes an observation, which is a generally true observation. If you look at communication and compare the points B and C. C, to be updated, requires a communicated point. B, to be updated, doesn't require a communicated point, but it requires a boundary value point. And so you can see there's an analogy between communication and conventional boundary values in differential equations. So if we now go on to the next foil. So this is something we commented on already when we Nancy discussed Hadrian's Wall. What is the basic relationship between the sequential and parallel computing models? In each case, you're actually doing the same basic algorithm. You're replacing the value of a potential by the average of the four neighbors. In the sequential case, the processor responsible for it is doing this over the whole domain. In the parallel case, it's doing it over 1/16th of the domain, and each node is solving the same problem, but you can see essentially the only difference is it's using different boundary conditions. It's looking at 1/16th of the domain, and then some of the boundary conditions are, if you like, set by communication, whereas in the sequential case, the boundary conditions are the ones given by the differential equation. So this was an observation we made that when you build Hadrian's Wall, if you used a single brick layer, you started at the east part of the wall and went to the west. If you did parallel processing and chopped the wall up into parts, each bricklayer built a wall, but then they had to negotiate with their neighbors where the two regions of the wall joined. So today the MPAC server is relatively sick, and it took a little while to load. So now we summarize the essential idea that for this class of problems, the only difference between the parallel and the sequential cases is the geometry and the boundary conditions. So this is a general feature of what is called an SPMD programming model. So that stands for single programming multiple data. So what that operationally means is that you write one computer program and you run the same computer program on each node of the parallel machine. They execute the same computer instructions, but you use different data for each of the computer programs, so they get different answers. So if you like, that is of course what you do again in this analogy with Hadrian's Wall, because when you do Hadrian's Wall, you can think of each bricklayer as being the node. They're each given the same instructions, which is the same programming, but because they're laying different parts of the wall, they are have different boundary conditions. So although this is not the most general programming model, it actually does the vast majority of scientific programming is not only can be done by SPMD, it is typically best done by SPMD. And so SPMD is an extremely important programming model. I don't know whether Nancy discussed these two, I think we discussed briefly these two types of parallel machines, so-called SIMD, which have fallen into disfavor, where everybody executes the same instruction, and MIMD, computer architectures. So when you take an SPMD programming model, you can usually run it in SIMD or MIMD models, because SIMD takes the same program, and not only runs the same program, it actually executes the same instruction at each clock period. In the MIMD version of SPMD, you run the same program, but a given computer can be at a different place in the program at a given time, so they do not have lockstep. The lockstep in MIMD model, the MIMD model of computing, is only at the boundary conditions. They have to agree when to transfer information. Other than that, they just do their own thing. That is, of course, what happened in the what happens in the case of the bricklayer. You give your bricklayer's instructions, then it is not true that everybody picks up mortar, puts it on the wall at exactly the same time, and then they each put a brick at exactly the same time. You give each bricklayer their own mortar, each bricklayer their own bricks, and they just complete the job in their own time. So human society is the MIMD model of computing. So this is a discussion of so-called guard rings, and guard rings are a convenient programming methodology, and they're a way of programming this class of equation in a way that gives you the same programming model in the parallel and sequential case. And the basic idea of guard rings is that you do not dimension the arrays only to contain the unknowns, you dimension the arrays to contain the unknowns and the boundary conditions, and the and in the case of parallel computing, the boundary conditions is not only the real boundary conditions, but it's the fake boundary conditions corresponding to the communicated points. And the reason you do that is that if you do that at the beginning, your program will actually run fast. You'll find that's the most efficient programming, because otherwise you'll find you have to put if statements inside your inner loop to take care of the special cases of boundary conditions. And the thing that slows down modern high-performance computers is if statements. The thing that they like to do best is just to run flat out and make no decisions. So in the case of, so you can use guard rings, if you like, in the sequential algorithm, where we know the unknown points are a 14 by 14 array, but we would not normally dimension phi to be 14 by 14. We dimension it to be 16 by 16, preload the boundary conditions on the first and the 16th row and column, and then we solve, and then we run the do loops from 2 to 15 to update the inner points. So the same is true in the parallel case. So in this particular example where we have a 4x4 array of unknowns, we could in principle just program up a 4x4 array to hold this, but in fact what we do is we dimension the local array to be 6x6, so it holds both the internal and the external points. So again, there's some special cases which, because of the boundary, the true boundary values, which means that some of the points are really 3x3, not 4x4. But in general, the simplest thing to do is to set up all your arrays as essentially 6x6. Again, you will not remember that on these parallel machines, essentially all nodes are the same, so you don't gain a lot by programming them up, putting a lot of effort to save time on any one machine. because the performance of the parallel machine is going to be dominated by the performance of the slowest machine. So there is no point in making machines which do less work run faster, because you can't use that extra extra time you save. So this is just an illustration of this special case of the corner, where in principle you only need a 5x5 array, but that's not not a terribly interesting issue, so let's not discuss it in detail. All right, so that's that part of the discussion was essentially meant to demonstrate for this type of problem the analogy between boundary conditions and communication, and the importance of guard rings, and the fact that the single programming multiple data programming model could be used. Now we want to use this example to analyze efficiency and speed up to see what affects the performance of these machines. I should have made the comment that because I'm very inadequate at drawing, everything is done in terms of these small 16 by 16 arrays. In a real world, you wouldn't be solving 16 by 16 two-dimensional arrays. You'll be solving 100 by 100 by 100 three-dimensional arrays. The analysis is identical for that case. It's just more complicated and requires more graphical skills, which I don't possess. So I believe the essence is shown in the examples I've drawn. All right, so we want to do speed up. And so we better define speed up. And so the speed up is very simply defined. Suppose you run a problem on one processor, and that takes a certain amount of time. Then you run the processor on a machine with p processors, and you call the time t sub p. The speed up is the ratio of t sub 1 over t sub p. T sub 1 is meant to be longer than t sub p because it's the sequential time, and t sub p is meant to be shorter. You would hope that it was shorter by a factor of p, so the speed up was equal to the number of processors, because that would be the most wonderful result, which would make us all very happy. But that's, of course, never going to be true, because that's perfection, which never happens. And so let's analyze why that doesn't happen. So there are, for this problem, two and only two reasons why the speed up is not the number of processors. And these are actually the two most important reasons for any problem. One is so-called load imbalance, and the other is so-called communication overhead. There are some examples where there are other issues, such that the parallel algorithm is not as good as the sequential algorithm, in which case the code you're running on a sequential machine may not be the same as the code you're running on a parallel machine, but that's not true. The code here on the sequential machine is the identical code as the code on the parallel machine. We already discussed that. They only differ in boundary conditions. So as you gain MPAC has just gone to sleep for a little while, so we have to gossip for a while. So as you may have heard, we went certain we could offer this class because this magnificent tornado went through Syracuse Sunday night, and actually most of MPAC's staff is without power. My house has no power and no water because Niagara Mohawk, our power utility, runs power on lines precisely so that when there's a storm, the storm knocks down trees, which knock down power lines, and then they spend the next week mending it. So that's what's happening at the moment. Power will be up in a week's time for several of us. All right, now MPAC has woken up, and so we can return to science. So, we're now looking at load imbalance. We have these two effects, load imbalance and communication. Essentially, looked at in the right way, these effects are additive, and so you can look at them separately. And so let's first look up at load imbalance. So the reason why we got load imbalance is for a reason I already said. Load imbalance means what it sounds like. It means that the amount of work on each processor is not the same. And we actually already decommented on that, because if we look at my parallel decomposition, which we can show on this old file we looked at here, this is run from the beginning, you will see on my 16 by 16 array, points on the bottom left have 9 unknowns, points in the processors are points. Processors on the bottom left, bottom right, top left, and top right, the four corner have 16. The ones in the middle have 9. The ones in the middle have 16. And the ones on the edge, which aren't corners, have 12 points to be updated. So the amount of work done by these processors is either 9 units of work, 16 units of work, or 12 units of work. So let's just go back to where we were. So to get the those are the number of updates to be done on each iteration. We know what the time each update takes. Naively, each update is 4 floating point operations. So the total calculation time per point is 4 times the floating point time. So on a typical machine, it does one floating point computation every clock cycle. So the floating point time on a 200 megahertz machine is 0.5 times 10 to the minus 8 seconds. So it's a pretty small number. So this means that we can actually analyze the speed-up in Laplace's example extremely simply, because speed-up, remember, was T1 divided by T16, which is the time it takes to do the calculation with 16 processors. T1, we decided, was 196 times TCalc, because there were 196 internal points. The time it takes for the 16 processor version to finish and do the computation is TCalc, the same time it takes to update one point, times the maximum number of points in any one processor, because the processors which only have to update 9 points, they update their 9 points, they have nothing to do for the remaining time while they wait for the others. So all you have to do is look for the processor which has the maximum amount of work, and that's the time it will take to do 16, to run on 16 processors. So T sub 16, the time for 16 processors, is 16 times T calc. So the speed up is by definition T1 over T16, which is 196 over 16, which is 12.25. So the speed up is not 16, it's reduced by a factor of about a quarter, 75% roughly of that is 12.25. And that's solely due to the fact that you have different number of points on each processor. So this fancy foil here, which is in a different color, does the mathematics of this in gory detail. As I pointed out, the previous analysis was done in this trivial case of 16 processors and 16 points. One actual sort of problem with that is the number 16 appears more than once, and sometimes it's the number of processors and sometimes it's the number of points. So here we've analyzed the general case where instead of 16 by 16 points we have m by n points. Instead of 16 processors, we have big P processors, where we've taken the one special case where P is a perfect square, so square root of P is an integer. And I guess I just noticed a very perceptive comment from Srinus, who asked why the corner or middle processors have to wait until the central points are updated. So that's a good question. The answer is they have to wait, and that's actually very important, because the reason they have to wait is actually, if you like, the reason why parallel computing works on these machines at all. So let's go back. So we'll come back to this analytic analysis and do all this mathematics, but let's go back to this foil here, which has these 16 processors in a 4x4 array. So we start them off running in parallel. So they each do their own thing. They have to first communicate the edge values to their neighbors. When the points are communicated, then they do their computation, and then they go and ask their neighbors for more points to communicate. And so if you think about that algorithm, you will see that these points, which only have these processors, which only have 9 points to process, they'll finish, and then they'll ask for some more data from their neighbors. But their neighbors won't have finished, and so they won't get anything. Actually, their neighbors have 12 points to process, so they'll finish after their 12 points. They'll then send the information to the corner, but that won't actually, but unfortunately, the points with 12, the processors with 12 points have to wait for the processors with 16 points to finish, because they all are waiting on communication. So the reason why the corner and middle processors have to wait, well, it's really the corner and edge processors have to wait, is they are not allowed to start the next iteration until the neighbors are able to finish their iteration and so can do their communication. And so all you have to do is to look for the processor which is going to hold everybody up, because it's going to give its communication last. And this may sound very sad, but actually it's actually very good, because this whole model of communication synchronizing the operation of these processes is extremely important, because it says that we do not have to worry about telling these processes when they can do anything. They just do their thing, they compute, then they wait for communication, and when the communication comes, they compute, then they communicate, wait for communication, and so on. So they're just in a cycle, which is sometimes called loosely synchronous. Europe, it's called bulk synchronization processing, where you have calculation, communicate, calculation, communicate, calculation, communicate, and communicate synchronizes the operation of the machine. And although it has the side effect that people with less work have to wait, it has the very positive effect that the waiting synchronizes, and the interesting thing is that the act of waiting is a local operation. Namely, a given processor waits for the results of its two, three, or four neighbors, and so it's a purely local operation. We do not have to send an instruction, say, start. We do right at the beginning, but we do not have to do it each iteration, because the act of waiting for communication synchronizes the operation of the machine. So that I would claim is an extremely important feature of these computations, that local message traffic is sufficient to synchronize and ensure that everybody remains in lockstep. Whereas otherwise, you would have a very inefficient command structure to ensure everybody kept on the same part of the problem. So did that? So Srinath, send me a chat room message if that was okay. All right. So now we're returning diligently to this foil marked 40, which is called analytic analysis of load imbalance. So remember, we had n squared points on p, which is square root of p squared processors, and we've assumed, to make life simple, that n is exactly divisible by root p. In the example we just gave, n was 16 and root p was 4, so n was exactly divisible by root p. So then the processor in the middle, by definition, has n squared over p points. If we calculate the t sub 1, it's big N minus 2, because the array in the middle is big N minus 2 times big N minus 2. So it's big N minus 2 squared times t sub calc. T on p processors is this thing called little n, big N squared over p times t sub calc. And so if you divide, if you put in the formula for the ln, calculate the speed up, you'll find the speed up is p into 1 minus 2 over n r squared. So actually, you got it to some extent, I see. So I'll come back to you, Shunas. So maybe this is one we'll also we'll get to some extent, because this is also another pretty important point. We will find out that this form of load imbalance is not very important, because as I make n, big N, bigger and bigger, you see that the number 1 minus 2 over big N r squared is going to be very near 1. Like if big N was 100, which is a more serious value than 16, then 1 minus 2 over 100 is 0.98, 0.98 squared is 0.96, so we only have a 4% overhead. So it turns out this form of load imbalance that we have here is not usually considered very seriously, because in practice it's not a very big effect, and the reason it is not a very big effect is we typically have lots of memory on each of our processors, and we run problems with lots of points in each processor in such a way that these edge effects, which is what's giving us the load imbalance, are relatively small. And so although it looks a relatively large effect on this example, that's an artifact of the fact that I can't draw, and the case with a maximum of 16 in each processor has an unusually large impact. So Srinath says that he sort of got it, but my explanation really wasn't that up to scratch. And so maybe he can send me another chat room message telling me which part of the argument he didn't get and what he thinks needs expansion, and I'll do that. Meanwhile, I'll continue with the next foil, which is perversely the wrong shape to make certain it displays badly on your computer. So now we remember there were two forms of overhead which gave us speed ups not equal to 1. One was load imbalance, which in this type of problem is not very important. The other is communication overhead, which is more important and is a larger effect on practical problems for this class of application. For some applications, load imbalance is actually quite important, even in the case where the problems are quite large. So to look at communication overhead, what we'll do is, again, we'll only look at the processor which has the most work, because actually the processor has the most floating point operations, also has the most communication, and therefore it's going to be slow for both purposes, because it's got to both communicate and process the most information. So it's going to dominate the total compute time, so we only have to look at these central processors. So we have this beautiful picture at the top of this foil, which has a 4x4 array in the middle, some faint blue lines, and some red crosses. And the red crosses are the points that must be communicated to the points inside the blue lines, which are the points owned by one of these general processors, in order to be able to do the update. We have to communicate 16 points and then update 16 points. So in order to calculate the total parallel computing time, we have to add the calculation time and the communication time. So when we do that, we get T16, the time it takes on 16 processors, to be 16 times tcalc plus 16 times tcom. So now we take speed up, which is T1, which is 196 times tcalc divided by T16, and we diligently do a bit of arithmetic. We find it's 12.25, that's the load imbalance number, over 1 plus tcom over tcalc, T-calc is 4 times a typical floating point number, and so it's 12.25 over 1 plus T-com over 4 T-float. You lost the foil. Did you lose Web Wisdom? That's John Eberle lost his foil. I bet he was playing around with it. You weren't playing around with it and you lost it. Well, it thinks you're there. Let me, what I'll do is, it should recreate. Are you on an SGI machine? Yeah, well, SGI, I need to, actually the code is not optimal in SGI. I need to edit this software on SGIs. You probably resized it. I know what you did. You did the correct thing. You resized it because this foil was a different shape. And in resizing on SGIs, it does something stupid and causes the system to disappear. Guilty as charged. Good. Well, I'm guilty because Roman pointed out this problem to me, and I know how to mend it. And because of, we'll blame the New York State weather that I didn't get around to mending it. But I know how to mend that problem. But it will restart. Actually, I think if you, it tells you what to do. It tells you to just click a button. You should click that button, and it will restart correctly. But you can also leave Web Wisdom and start again. It will be fine. All right. So the end result of this little discussion about SGIs and reloading is we'll go back to something serious, this communication overhead. Doing a little bit of algebra, we find it's 12.25, and then it's 1 minus, and then it's multiplied approximately 1 minus t-com over 4 t-float, written in a font that's too small to be seen. So now let's go to the next foil, which uses a slightly different font, but still pretty screwed up. And it does the same thing with the same notation we did before, with big N by big N points, and little n, the so-called grain size, is big N squared over p, points in each processor. So alright, so when we do the same arithmetic, we get for the total speed up, we find that the speed up is big P into 1 minus 2 over big N all squared. That's the load imbalance number. And then we have a term for communication, which is 1 plus T-com over the square root of the grain size times t float. So this is actually a pretty important formula. The one that's important is the fact that the communication overhead is got this formula which you can't read. I should redraw these foils as t com over square root of n t float. So that's actually discussed on the next foil, because it turns out we got the same answer in Laplace's wall, building Laplace's wall as we do here. And in fact, the general formula for communication overhead is given in this form here. If you want to get it to look exactly right, we have to introduce something called the overhead, which is defined in this rather pompous fashion here. That's because the communication appears at the bottom in the speed up, and therefore to make it look nice, we have to bring it to the top. And we find this overhead is always of this magic form. It's a constant. It's constant times the typical communication time. It's the grain size, which is the number of points inside the inside each processor, raised to 1 over the number, the dimension, the geometric dimension of the problem, or multiplied by the floating point execution time. So the critical thing is that It's also, there's just lots of interesting features, this formula. So the dimension of the problem was 2 for Laplace's example, it's 1 for Hadrian's wall, it's 3 for a three-dimensional problem. And so actually on a typical large problem, n is, say, for a 2D problem, in reality n might be, I don't know, maybe it's 10,000 or something like that. So n to the 1 over d is more like 100. So in a real problem, this square root of n factor is actually pretty small. And what's t calm over t calc? So actually t calm over t calc is an essential feature of the hardware. There is the ratio of the typical floating point, typical communication time, to the typical floating point time. And this is a measure, so this actually is an important formula because it shows how the work you do in building your parallel computer, how it manifests itself in terms of the performance of the computer. If you build a wonderful network with a very high performance, then TCOM is relatively small. If you build a lousy network, like put workstations underneath the net, TCOM is very high, and then this communication overhead is a serious effect. And so when you characterize parallel machines, the critical thing to characterize them by is TCOM over TFloat. Now, if you look at a real machine, TCOM over TFloat is something like a factor of 10 to 30. I mean, it takes longer to communicate a word than it does to do a floating point calculation. Because you can do a floating point calculation in either one cycle or maybe even two per cycle, clock cycle, you typically cannot communicate one word each clock cycle. And as machines are getting faster, it's actually getting harder to make the communication time track the floating point calculation time. All right. So, all right, that's actually the end of that aspect of the analysis. This last foil is a very old foil of historical nostalgia for me. Because when I first started discussing parallel computing, actually I used this particular example, and I was told that everything I deduced was only a product of this example and would not properly generalize. However, it turns out that the analysis we did here, which said that up to a modest numerical factor, the overhead, which is essentially one minus the overhead is how much the speed up differs in the number of processors. We found that that overhead just goes like these, is only dependent on two things. Something to do with the grain size raised to the inverse of the 1 over the dimension, and due to this hardware ratio TCOM over TCALC. So people told me that was a feature only of this problem, and if I did more complicated problems, I would find a worse circumstance and the communication would get worse. Well, it's very important to notice that actually the communication gets better as you do more complicated problems. And the reason is, there's a very important observation. It is that as you make problems more and more complicated, if you go to CWES and do some of their complex environmental modeling, you will find they're also doing geometrical decompositions, they're also doing this type of communication, but actually the performance is better, not worse. The reason is that as you make the problem more complicated, your communication gets more and more. But if you look at it, you'll find the calculation gets more and more as well, and the calculation tends to get more complicated faster than the communication gets more complicated. And here I have some examples. Here I only do it by example. You can analyze it in various ways to convince yourself that although this problem I did has the smallest communication, it also has the smallest calculation, and the ratio is about as bad as it can get. So actually Laplace's equation is not the easiest one to do, it's the hardest. All All right, so before we do this deep and brilliant general analysis, which is a slightly different point, we'll return back to Schrinus, who has noticed that we have a stupid algorithm. Namely, we have four corners and four edge processors waiting around till the four central points complete their job. Which means that if we were running a bunch of bricklayers, and we had made our bricklayers do this, we'd be fired as an incompetent manager. So he says correctly, is it efficient? Well, the answer is it's not efficient. So let's just go back to foil 5, which has this. So here we have our magic foil, which has this four types of processors, the 16, the 12, and the 9-node processors. So Schrinus points out that actually, as we have 196 points and 16 processors, we could do a more efficient decomposition where probably each of them had about 12 points rather than some having 16, some having 9, and some having 12. And the answer is, in principle, you can do that. So you can start trying to, and the reason we got this load imbalance was because I was lazy and took my 16 by 16 grid and divided into four equal segments, but I did not take account of the boundary values. So if I took account of the boundary values and divided it differently, I could possibly do a more efficient decomposition. However, the observation one makes is that when you start doing that next optimization, you can no longer do the simple square blocks. You have to do more complicated geometrical shapes. And although you can write software that processes more complicated geometrical shapes, you will find the if statements that you put in your software to process the more complicated shapes more than make up for the time you the time gained by having the load imbalance. And so though you have a load balance problem, you will not have as high a performance problem. So I noticed that the JSU video has just disappeared. Can you hear me still? Okay, Strinus, does that answer your question? All right, so CWAS can hear me. All right, so I don't know what's happening. Is JSU still alive? Yes, Srinus can see me. Well, Srinus seems happy. So he's the one person who chats a lot, so we'll assume everything's okay if he's fine. All right, so given the amount of time, let me just finish this. So we are at this foil here. So this foil here, again, does the same problem, but it imagines different algorithms. So it's got the same geometry, but it has different algorithms which involve different amounts of communication, and therefore different ratios of communication to calculation. And they're specified by this so-called stencil. So the stencil is just the array of points which specify what's involved in doing the update. So if I look at this case marked B, the case marked B has one central point which is updated not by four nearest neighbors, by eight nearest neighbors. So we can actually see the central point here. So if I update with eight nearest neighbors, that corresponds to a higher order differencing, more accurate formula. I immediately double the communication. But if you look at the actual numerical, the arithmetic done in the update, you'll find actually the update, it goes from four times, it goes from four floating point operations to nine floating operations, so it's slightly more than double. This essentially doubled again. So the ratio up to a 10% effect is identical. We double the communication, but we also double the calculation. the overhead and therefore the speed up only depends on the ratio, so it's unchanged. Here is actually even more interesting example at the bottom there, where each point is dependent not only on the nearest neighbors, but on the edge points as well. So we update each point by all the points which are the nearest neighbors or actually next to the nearest neighbors. They're the ones at the corner. So we do 8 points we use in the update. You'll find that there the actual communication overhead goes down by roughly a factor of 2. So that example here is generalized on the next foil, which let me just, so that was the foil we looked at, and here's the next foil. So curiously, at least my monitoring machine doesn't see the next foil, but that's this one here. All right, so now it's got it. I'm sorry. Again, the impact servers on strike. All right, so if we now increase the size of this update stencil, so instead of nearest neighbors, we do points which are getting further and further away, you will find that the ratio of communication to calculation actually gets smaller and smaller as you make the as you include more and more points. Communication always grows as you make the stencil bigger, but calculation, if you analyze it, grows faster than communication. And we'll come and see an extreme example of this when we do the so-called n-body problem, where each point is updated by a calculation which depends on all other points, and we'll find that the overhead is very much smaller in that case. And instead of going like 1 over the square root of n, goes like 1 over n. N is again, this little n is always this grain size, the number of points stored in each processor. The next two foils are extremely old foils. The only purpose of them is to show that this analysis is mathematically correct. So here, this is actually shows you a good way of plotting performance results. This is a very old piece of data, and it plots something. It shows that if you plot things which, according to this formula, everything lies on the correct straight line. So the correct straight lines are these ones marked for this matrix multiplication, and for large enough little n, which means small enough 1 over root n, the measure points, which are the squares and which are the crosses and the circles and and the open squares, etc., they all lie on these universal curves. Then the next foil corresponds to again a set of I guess I'm a little, the reason why I'm confused is it's not occurred, it's again not loaded on my machine. So, this stupid server is not giving me my answer. So, what I'm going to do is I have to just move over and talk from another display where it has deigned to load. So the only purpose of these measurements here, which is actually a more conventional plot of efficiency, as a function of the number of nodes, is the dashed line, which is called fixed grain size. So if you do fixed grain size, then that corresponds to a fixed value of little n, and as long as you have a fixed value of little n, then I'm sorry, I'm causing you great chaos. That's because my machine's broke. All right, so here we are. All right, so if you do a fixed value of little n, which is a fixed grain size, you will find that whatever the number of nodes, you'll find the efficiency is constant. That's because the efficiency only depends on the grain size and the T comma over T calc, and it does not depend on the number of nodes. So as you make a, so if you keep the grain size fixed, and as you double the number of nodes, you double the problem size, you will find a fixed efficiency. So that's a very important observation, which is sometimes called scaled speed up. That the speed up is a constant fraction of the processes as long as you keep the grain size fixed. And you can show on general principles why you expect that to be true. And this is, again, and whether there are these few fundamental principles, this is why parallel computing works. So parallel computing works because scaled speedup has constant efficiency. Scaled speedup is actually the natural thing to use because if you fix the grain size, that corresponds to building machines with fixed memory. Because you have a certain amount of memory, you should use it because memory costs real money. And so the natural thing to do when you double the number of nodes of fixed memory is to actually double the problem size. And if you do that, you'll find your speed up as a fraction of the number of processors is the same. It's the same fraction of the number of processors. You double the nodes, you double the speed up. So this is actually the essential principle that is shown on the next foil, which is the last foil of this set. We have to come back to the beginning next time to discuss programming, which says that the speed up at fixed grain size is just linear. Speed up, scale speed up is linear in the number of nodes. If you fix the problem size and increase the number of nodes, then as you double the number of nodes, you'll halve the number of points in each processor. And so if you that decreases the value of little n. If you look at all those formulae, both the load imbalance and the communication overhead increase as you decrease the number of points in each node. Therefore, the fixed problem size graph of speed up against the number of nodes, it starts off linear because it's in a regime when it can't see these small effects. Then as the grain size gets smaller, then the speed up levels off. So we discussed that in Hadrian's Wall. We noted it was called too many cooks spoil the broth. Namely, if you have a fixed size problem, you can't make the number of processors arbitrarily large because the amount of work for each processor gets too small, and therefore you get dominated by control and synchronization overheads. So the correct limit to take is you need to keep the amount of work in each node reasonably big. And so parallel computing always works for this class of problem as long as the problem is big enough. It will not work if the problem is small because then these overheads like load imbalance and communication will get, those overheads will get too large. So the claim is that when CWEST just upgraded its process, its machines, the bigger machines, it will see that those machines will continue to be used efficiently as long as when you run big jobs on them, you actually run bigger jobs than before. And that typically people are actually buying parallel machines to run large jobs, so they are naturally making the jobs larger as the machines get larger. So everything is just fine. Okay, so that's the end of that section. So I don't think there's time to start the next section on programming. So are there any questions on what we learned up to now? So we're meant to analyze that simple example and deduce from it some general principles from particular calculations. So we didn't do the general case. But I claim the answers were general, and my claim is correct. You have to believe me. When you get more experience, you'll be able to convince yourself of that. And so that the essential principle is that the overheads are all local effects. The synchronization, which is what ensures parallelism is low overhead, is local. people just wait for messages. And then the critical thing is tcom over tcalc, the typical ratio of communication to calculation time. And the thing that multiplies that depends only on the grain size. And actually, it's typically a constant divided by the grain size to 1 over the geometrical dimension, which is 1, 2, or 3 in real problems. So that's what you need to know. Any questions? Okay, well, have a good time.